Okay, so I want you to picture the most buttoned-up, beige-walled corporate meeting room you can possibly imagine.
Oh, I can picture it.
Right. It's 1999. We are in Redmond, Washington, and this is Microsoft at the absolute peak of its suit and tie era.
Yeah, this is the company that gave us Windows 98 and Excel.
Exactly. They completely own the desktop. They are the undisputed kings of productivity and spreadsheets and, corporate efficiency.
And arguably the most uncool company on the planet at that specific moment. At least if you were under the age of 30.
Totally.
Yeah.
And suddenly, right in the middle of this empire of efficiency, someone stands up and says, "Hey, you know Sony, the company making the coolest consumer electronics in history. Let's go pick a fight with them."
In the living room, no less.
Right. In their own backyard. It just sounds completely insane, doesn't it?
It sounds like a midlife crisis, honestly. It's like a champion accountant suddenly deciding to step into the ring with a heavyweight boxer because they think they can calculate the punch velocity.
That is the perfect analogy. But that single kind of audacious decision kicked off what has become a 23-year roller coaster ride. So today we are doing a deep dive into the source material titled The Green Giant, a 23-year history of Xbox strategy.
It's a fascinating document.
It really is. We are tracking this journey from the very first bulky box in 2001 all the way to today, Monday, February 23rd, 2026. And looking at the research, this isn't even really a story about video games, is it?
No, not really. If
Eh.
you look closely at the sources, it's actually a business thriller about fear.
Fear.
Yeah, pure strategic paranoia. If you look at the internal memos from that time, Bill Gates didn't greenlight the Xbox project because he had this sudden burning passion for playing Mario or Sonic.
Right.
He did it because he was terrified.
Terrified of what exactly? Because Microsoft was basically invincible in the late 90s.
He was terrified of the PlayStation 2. You have to remember, in the late 90s, Sony wasn't just selling a game console, they were marketing the PS2 as a Trojan horse for the living room.
Ah, because it played DVDs.
Exactly, which was a massive deal back then. The fear inside Microsoft was that if the PlayStation became the primary computer in the home, the hub where everyone spent their time, then the Windows PC would just get pushed into the home office and die this slow, irrelevant death.
So the Xbox wasn't designed as a toy. It was a defensive wall.
It was a multi-billion dollar shield designed to stop Sony from stealing the future of computing.
Wow. Which brings us to layer one of our deep dive. The Green Giant itself, November 2001.
The original Xbox lands.
And looking at the specs in these notes, it is honestly hilarious. It wasn't really a console architecture in the traditional sense, was it?
Not at all.
It was literally a Dell PC dressed up in a black plastic disguise.
That is the most accurate way to describe it. It was built with off-the-shelf parts. It ran on an Intel Pentium III processor and an NVIDIA graphics card.
Which was unheard of for consoles.
Right, because at the time, Nintendo and Sony were building these elegant, custom chips designed specifically from the ground up for gaming.
And Microsoft just took what they knew PC architecture and shoved it into a box.
Exactly. And that's why the console was so physically large. It had to be massive just to fit all those standard PC components and keep them from melting.
I vividly remember the controller too,
Yeah.
the Duke.
Oh, the Duke.
It was the size of a dinner plate. You needed hands the size of a professional basketball player just to reach the buttons.
It was definitely clunky. But even with the clunky design, the research highlights two specific hardware choices that Microsoft made here that actually changed the entire industry.
Okay, let's unpack those. What were they?
The internal hard drive and the Ethernet port.
Right. Why were those such a huge deal?
Well, context is key here. Before the Xbox, consoles didn't have internal storage. You had to buy those flimsy little plastic memory
Oh
cards.
man, I remember those.
And if you lost the card or if it got corrupted, you just lost 40 hours of progress in Final Fantasy.
It was devastating.
Truly. So the Xbox having an 8 GB hard drive built in meant developers could create persistent worlds, they could store more data, and you could rip music from CDs directly to the console.
I completely forgot about ripping CDs. Being able to listen to your own music while playing a driving game, it just felt like magic back then.
It was a huge shift. And then there's the Ethernet port.
Yeah.
Because in 2001, almost nobody had broadband internet. We were all still screeching on dial-up modems.
So why include a broadband port?
That was their massive gamble. They bet the farm that high-speed internet would eventually become the standard in American homes. That port allowed for the creation of Xbox Live in November 2002.
They were building the infrastructure for online gaming before the internet was even really ready for it.
Exactly. A unified subscription-based service.
But strictly speaking, if we look at the sales numbers in the report, The original Xbox got absolutely crushed, didn't it?
Oh, brutally crushed.
Yeah, the PlayStation 2 sold a staggering 155 million units.
Yeah.
And the Xbox...
it managed about 24 million.
Wow. In almost any other business, you fire the CEO and shut down the division with numbers like that.
You really do. But history views it as a success because of a concept called the loss leader.
Okay, explain that.
Microsoft lost roughly $4 billion on the original Xbox project. They lost money on every single console they sold.
$4 billion.
Yeah. But that money bought them a seat at the table. They established a beachhead in the living room. And crucially, they did it on the back of a single piece of software.
Halo. Combat Evolved.
Exactly.
Halo is such an interesting case study because before that game, first-person shooters, where you see the world through the eyes of the character, they were considered terrible on console.
Oh, they were unplayable.
Everyone thought you absolutely needed a mouse and keyboard to aim. If you tried to play a shooter on a PlayStation 1, it was a nightmare. You were basically fighting the controls the whole time.
Right. But Bungie, the developer behind Halo, basically invented modern aim assist.
That subtle magnetic pull that helped your crosshair stick to the target?
Exactly. It made shooters feel fluid while sitting on a couch with a controller.
Yeah.
Halo didn't just sell the Xbox. It proved the killer app model. People weren't buying the hardware because they loved Microsoft.
They were buying the hardware just to play as Master Chief.
Spot on. And then Halo 2 comes along and cements that online console gaming culture through Xbox Live.
So they survive round one. They took a massive financial beating, but they're still standing. Which brings us to layer two, the golden age. November 2005. The launch of the Xbox 360.
This is where strategy really meets execution. They learned from the first round. The biggest strategic win here was simply showing up early.
They beat the PlayStation 3 to market by a full year, right?
They did. And that first mover advantage is huge in this industry.
It's everything. Mm. By the time Sony finally launched the PS3, your friends were already on Xbox Live. They had already built up their gamer score.
Exactly. And if all your friends are on Xbox, you aren't going to buy a PlayStation and play by yourself.
Yeah.
But the real secret weapon for the 360 was the architecture. And this gets a little technical, but it's vital to understand why the 360 felt so dominant.
Lay it on us. Why did games generally look and run better on the 360 compared to the PS3?
It comes down to developer difficulty. The PlayStation 3 used something called the Cell processor. It was incredibly powerful, like supercomputer level stuff.
Right.
But it was like trying to fly an alien spaceship. It was complex, asymmetrical, and notoriously hard to program for.
Whereas the Xbox 360 used a triple-core power PC chip.
Right. It was symmetrical. It made sense. It was familiar to anyone who would program for a PC.
So if I'm a third-party developer making Call of Duty or Assassin's Creed, I make it for Xbox first because it's easier, and then I struggle to port it to PlayStation later.
Precisely. And that resulted in the Xbox version almost always running smoother, or having better frame rates. It gave the perception that the Xbox was the more powerful console, even though on paper the PS3 had more raw potential.
So they're winning. They have the games, they have the online service, they have the price advantage. But then, disaster strikes. The Red Ring of Death.
Oh boy.
Yeah. We have to pause here because looking at the failure rates in this source, estimates between 23% and 54% for early units, that is catastrophic.
It's an engineering nightmare. It is one of the worst consumer electronics failures in history.
For those who don't know the engineering why behind it, what actually happened inside that box, I had one. And I remember wrapping it in towels because the internet said that would fix it.
Please tell me you didn't do that.
I totally did.
That actually made it worse.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the problem was thermal stress. The console would get very hot while you played, which caused the motherboard to expand slightly. Then you'd turn it off and it would cool down and contract.
Okay, that makes sense.
But they used a specific type of lead-free solder to connect the graphics chip to the board. That constant expanding and contracting literally cracked the solder balls over time.
So the connection just broke.
Eventually, the chip would just disconnect from the board entirely.
Pop. Three red lights, your console is a brick.
Exactly. And here is a massive takeaway regarding leadership. Peter Moore, who was running Xbox at the time, had to go to Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, and asked for $1.15 billion to fix it.
That is a terrifying meeting to be in, just walking in and saying, hey, Steve, I need $1 billion for broken solder.
He basically said, if we don't fix this, the brand is dead. And to Ballmer's credit, he didn't hesitate. He wrote the check, They extended the warranty to 3 years for every single person.
It was a massive financial hit, but it saved the brand's reputation.
Absolutely. If they had tried to hide it or deny it, Xbox would have died right there in 2007.
So amidst all this, they also tried to chase the casual market with the Kinect. This was the motion camera where, quote, you are the controller.
Right. Their answer to the Nintendo Wii.
The notes say it sold 24 million units, making it the fastest selling consumer electronics device ever at the time.
Yeah.
But nobody talks about it anymore. Was it a success or a failure?
It was a commercial success, but a cultural failure.
How so?
I mean, selling 24 million units is insane. But the core gamers, the people who buy Halo and Gears of War, they absolutely hated it.
It felt like a gimmick to them.
Exactly. It took development resources away from real games.
Yeah.
And the casual grandmas who bought it for the bowling game eventually just migrated to playing games on their iPhones and iPads. It was a dead end.
Which sets the perfect stage for what is widely considered the biggest faceplant in gaming history. Layer 3. The 2013 reveal. The Xbox One era.
Hubris.
Yeah.
Pure corporate hubris.
I rewatched the reveal presentation while preparing for this deep dive. It is physically painful to watch. Don Matrick, the Xbox boss at the time, gets on stage. You're expecting to see games. But all he keeps saying is TV, sports, TV, Call of Duty Ghosts, and then more TV.
They completely forgot who their customer was.
Yeah.
They thought they had the gamers in the bag, so they tried to pivot and sell a cable box replacement. But the dark irony is they bet on cable TV right when Netflix was about to kill it.
They were skating to where the puck was, not where it was going.
Exactly.
And the policies. Let's unpack these because they were absolutely brutal. They wanted to ban used games.
It was even worse than that. It was a trifecta of control. First, the always online requirement. They mandated a 24-hour check-in. If your internet went down for a day, your $500 console became a paperweight.
You couldn't even play single-player offline games.
Nope. Second, they restricted disc lending. You couldn't just hand a physical game to a friend. There were all these weird digital licensing restrictions.
And third,
they forced you to buy the new Kinect camera bundled with the system, which drove the price up to $500.
While the PlayStation 4 was launching at $399.
Exactly. So think about that value proposition. You were paying $100 more for a weaker machine because technically the Xbox One was putting out 1.31 teraflops compared to the PS4's 1.84.
Right.
That spied on you with a mandatory camera and wouldn't let you share games with your friends.
And Sony. I mean, Sony must have been popping champagne in their offices. They released that instructional video right after. Do you remember it?
Oh, the game sharing video.
Yes. It's just two Sony executives looking at the camera. One says, step one, hand game to friend. And he just passes the plastic case to the other guy.
It was a complete humiliation. It went viral instantly, and the sales reflected it over that generation. The PS4 sold over 117 million units. The Xbox One struggled to hit 51 million.
Microsoft lost the generation before it even really started.
They did.
But this is where the redemption arc begins. Enter Phil Spencer in 2014. And this is really the start of the modern era strategy that brings us to where we are today in 2026.
Phil Spencer's appointment was the major turning point. He wasn't just a suit. He actively played games. He understood the culture. And he did something extremely rare in corporate America.
What's that?
He admitted they were wrong.
Wow.
He did a complete 180 on the policies. He unbundled the Kinect to drop the price. He killed the hated always online requirements. But his biggest strategic move was backward compatibility.
This is honestly my favorite feature. Being able to put a 10-year-old Xbox 360 disc into the new machine and it just works. It feels like magic.
It is an emulation miracle. From a technical standpoint, it is incredibly difficult to make that work.
Right.
But strategically, it was about trust. It told gamers, we respect the money you've already spent with us over the last decade. Your library is safe here. It slowly rebuilt that fractured relationship.
However, looking at the modern era, Layer 4, they still had a massive problem. They didn't have the games.
That's the persistent issue.
Sony was dropping hit after hit, God of War, Spider-Man, The Last of Us, Ghost of Tsushima. And Xbox had, they had Halo Infinite, which was fine.
It was fine, but fine doesn't sell hardware.
Same with Starfield. Good, but maybe not a generational system seller.
Right. Microsoft realized they had a systemic issue with their development studios. Mm. They just couldn't produce those 10 out of 10 masterpieces consistently. So, unable to beat Sony on the exclusive blockbuster model, Microsoft changed the rules of the game completely.
They stopped trying to sell boxes.
And started selling a service. Game Pass.
The Netflix of gaming.
Yeah. Exactly. This is the fundamental business model shift for Xbox. Instead of asking you to pay $70 for every new game, they ask for a monthly subscription. You get access to hundreds of games, including their brand new releases, on day one.
Which shifts all their business metrics from units sold to monthly recurring revenue and user retention.
They don't need you to buy a physical game anymore. They just need you to stay subscribed to the ecosystem.
Which leads us directly to layer 5, the content monopoly. Because if you need people to stay subscribed every single month, you need content. You need a massive, constant drip feed of new stuff.
So the checkbook came out.
The big checkbook.
The very big checkbook. First, they bought Bethesda, the makers of Skyrim and Fallout, for $7.5 billion. That was huge.
Yeah.
That was really just the appetizer. The main course was Activision Blizzard.
$68.7 billion.
Completed in October 2023.
That number is still hard to wrap my head around. That's the GDP of a small country.
It is the largest acquisition in the history of the tech industry, not just gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And with that single purchase, they bought Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Overwatch, and this is crucial, King, the makers of Candy Crush.
People always forget about Candy Crush when talking about this deal.
Which is funny because Candy Crush makes an absolute fortune on mobile.
Yeah.
But yes, overnight, they became the third largest publisher in the world by revenue, right behind Tencent and Sony.
And this creates the weird dynamic we are living in right now in 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft owns Call of Duty. They sell it on PlayStation for $70 to make money from Sony players, but they put it on Game Pass for quote-unquote free to lure people into their own ecosystem.
It's a double dip.
They're profiting from their biggest enemy while trying to undercut them at the exact same time.
It's a strategic stranglehold. They are supplying their biggest competitor with their biggest game, while simultaneously holding the keys to the subscription future.
So let's check in on the reality here in February 2026. Microsoft has a split hardware strategy. We have the Series X, the big high-power fridge-looking tower with 12 teraflops for the hardcore gamers.
Yep.
And we have the Series S, the little budget toaster that maxes out at 1440p with no disk drive for the casuals. And we have this massive Game Pass subscription service. Is it working?
It's complicated. If you look at the data, the traditional console war is effectively over, but the screen time war is brutal.
Explain the difference.
Microsoft's vision is an ecosystem accessible on PC, console, cloud, and mobile. But they face challenges. The cloud gaming tech, the idea that you can just stream Halo to your phone without owning a console,
yeah.
It's improving, but it's hitting the laws of physics.
Latency.
Right. Latency, the literal time it takes for you to press A on your controller for that signal to travel to a server farm in Virginia, process the jump, and send the video feedback to your screen.
And if you're playing a competitive shooter, even 50 milliseconds of delay feels like you're swimming in molasses.
Exactly. So the dedicated local console isn't dead yet.
And there's a serious management tension here, too. Microsoft now owns over 30 studios. They have to manage thousands of developers. And we've seen that managing culture at that scale, especially with the heavy baggage that Activision Blizzard brought regarding its workplace culture, is an absolute nightmare.
It is a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
When you spend almost $70 billion, the shareholders don't just want participation in the market. They want complete dominance. The pressure on these 30-plus studios to finally deliver consistent hits is higher than it has ever been.
So let's synthesize this whole 23-year journey. We started with a company in 2001 that was terrified of losing the PC market to a Japanese electronics giant. They built a clunky PC in a box. They nearly went broke fixing the Red Ring of Death. They alienated everyone with their TV arrogance in 2013. And now they are basically the landlord of the gaming industry.
That is a great way to put it. They moved from being a hardware manufacturer to being a digital infrastructure company. Phil Spencer's been very clear about this. They don't care if you play on an Xbox Series X, a gaming PC, a Samsung Smart TV app, or an iPhone.
As long as your credit card is linked to a Game Pass subscription, they win.
They win. The console war morphed. It's not about who sells the most plastic boxes anymore. It's about who controls the screen time on any device you happen to be looking at.
It really feels like the hardware itself, the actual plastic box sitting under the TV, is becoming less relevant every single year.
It's becoming an option, not a requirement. It's for the enthusiasts. But for the mass market, the app is the destination.
So here is my final provocation for you, the listener. We've spent this entire deep dive talking about teraflops, fan speeds, disk drives, and proprietary memory cards. But in a world where Call of Duty is just an app on your phone and the console is just a blade in a server farm in the desert somewhere, do we lose something?
What do you mean?
I mean, there was a real ritual to the console. Blowing into the cartridge, holding that weird, massive Duke controller, having that specific machine sitting under the TV like a centerpiece. If Xbox just becomes an app icon right next to Netflix and TikTok on your TV, does the identity of being a gamer disappear? Does it all just become content consumption?
That is the $69 billion question. I think as long as there are people who want the absolute best possible experience, there will be boxes. But for the rest of the world, the app might just win.
Definitely something for you to chew on the next time you boot up whatever screen you play on. Thanks for diving into this history with us.
Always a pleasure.